America Looks Abroad, presented at this hour on Sunday afternoon by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, which is open to all who are interested, offers accurate information on current world events. The President's annual message to Congress, delivered in Washington, focuses attention on the impact of wars abroad, and the Foreign Policy Association today presents the director of its Washington Bureau, William T. Stone, who speaks from the NBC studios in the nation's capital. Mr. Stone.
Good afternoon. Washington was a center of world interest this week as millions of Americans and peoples of many warring and neutral nations sought to discover in President Roosevelt's message to Congress the role which the United States will play in the critical times which lie ahead. Last week, the President's message was read almost as closely in London and Paris, in Rome and Tokyo, as it was in New York and San Francisco. It was broadcast on long and short waves and translated in five languages. If it could not be heard by the man on the street in Berlin or Moscow, it was nevertheless read and studied even there by diplomats and political commissars. For what the President had to report on the State of the Union could not be divorced from the state of the world. Mr. Roosevelt had much to say about the state of the world and our own relation to what is happening abroad. His message was first and foremost a report on foreign affairs. It was more restrained, less provocative, less specific than his message a year ago. Last year, you remember, he called for methods short of war, but stronger and more effective than mere words to bring home to aggressor governments the aggregate sentiments of our own people. That was 9 weeks before Germany's occupation of Czechoslovakia and 9 months before the outbreak of hostilities in Europe. Last week, with Europe at war, the President spoke in a subdued but serious tone. He voiced the hope of the vast majority of his fellow citizens that the United States will not become involved in military participation. But he did not retreat from the stand he took a year ago. He flatly rejected the idea that we can escape the shock of war by pretending, like ostriches, that what is happening abroad is none of our business. He insisted that it is our business, that our own domestic welfare, our destiny, and the destiny of our children is tied up with the future of Western civilization. Mr. Roosevelt found it unnecessary to name any country, but his meaning was perfectly clear. We need only look abroad, he said, to see the possibilities for our children if the rest of the world comes to be dominated by force alone. We must look ahead and see the effect on our future generations if world trade is controlled by any nation or group of nations which sets up that control through military force. To Congress, the President made only two specific requests. First, increased appropriations for national defense. Second, renewal of Secretary Hull's trade agreements program as an indispensable part of the foundation for any stable and enduring peace. Mr. Roosevelt did not try to define the terms of such a peace. He did not say when it might be possible to consider a peace settlement. And he made no attempt to give a direct answer to a host of questions which might be asked about the course of the United States in the period which lies immediately ahead. Some of these questions, however, have been raised by recent events, both at home and abroad. For example, does the appointment of Myron C. Taylor as the President's personal representative at the Vatican mean that the administration expects a new peace offensive in the near future? Would the United States be prepared to join with the Pope or other neutral countries in making an offer of mediation now, before the war is intensified? If the time is not yet ripe, what are the conditions under which we might be prepared to act? Are we committed to an Allied victory, or do we see any prospect of a negotiated settlement on the basis of a military stalemate? Finally, what would be our policy if the war should spread to other fronts, or if Great Britain and France should seem to be in danger of defeat? While Mr. Roosevelt does not answer these questions directly, he gives a clear indication of his own outlook and the present attitude of the administration. He does not appear to think that the time is ripe for a successful peace move. He gives little encouragement to the small European neutrals who fear that if the war cannot be stopped before next summer, they will lose their independence and be swallowed up by their powerful neighbors. He gives no evidence that the administration would support the idea of Prime Minister de Valera of Ireland, who has urged the belligerents to hold a peace conference now rather than after a long war, which would end in an atmosphere of fury and resentment, of hate and fear. To most Washington observers and foreign diplomats, the president's message to Congress confirms the impression of earlier statements, namely that the administration will not at this moment initiate any move looking toward negotiations with Hitler, that it will be cool toward peace feelers from Berlin, that it will not encourage other countries to approach the present German or Russian governments. Any of these moves, in the president's opinion, would merely play into the hands of those nations which seek to rule the world by force. It might lead to a temporary truce, but it would fail to provide a sound basis for a stable and lasting peace. If peace negotiations are not considered possible now, what, then, are the immediate prospects? Lord Lothian, the British ambassador to the United States, gave an important clue to British opinion on this question in a speech delivered in Chicago last Thursday. He said that the real key to the struggle between Germany and the Allies is not territory, but sea power. He believed that Germany would probably throw all of her forces into a terrific attack by land, sea, and air early in the spring, aimed primarily at British sea power. Explaining this thesis, the British ambassador said, I quote, "If Germany can defeat England, either by direct attack on her naval and sea communications, or on France through Belgium or the Maginot Line, and compel us to surrender our fleet, or a large part of it, and the naval bases, whereby fleets may travel all over the globe, Germany will then be on top of the world. The opposition to her in Europe will disappear. Most of the other nations will hasten to get on her bandwagon, and she will be able to dictate the basis on which world politics will be conducted." I continue to quote, "We feel," Lord Lothian continued, "that the only foundation for a stable and liberal world will be the control of the seas on agreed principles by the democracies." This may be regarded, in some quarters, as British propaganda. However, it undoubtedly represents an accurate statement of informed British opinion today. It also represents a view which is shared by many, if not most, of President Roosevelt's foreign policy advisors here in Washington. For administration advisors believe that if British sea power should be destroyed, the United States would be exposed to many dangers in the Western Hemisphere. We would also be forced to assume greater responsibilities in the Far East, and perhaps to maintain a two-ocean navy and a greatly increased standing army and air force. This was the real reason behind the demand for neutrality revision last fall. To avoid these threatened dangers and to protect our own interests, the president believes that we must support the Allies by all measures short of sending American armies to Europe or the Far East. But if the Allies should really appear to be in danger of defeat, the logic of this thesis would compel us to reconsider our position. Under such conditions, we would have to ask ourselves whether even military intervention would not be necessary. For the moment, this is an academic question, as there seems little prospect of an early German victory or an overwhelming Allied defeat. But the future of this war is unpredictable, and the question may someday demand an answer. That is why a few voices in Washington are still asking whether we should not hold the door open, more widely than we have, for a negotiated peace settlement. A peace conference, they argue, might be possible if moderate forces in Germany were given a chance to organize an effective opposition to Hitler and the Nazi regime. As a result of the Soviet-German pact, some observers find a growing revulsion among the masses of people in all countries, including Germany, against the extremes of both Nazism and communism, and a growing desire for a moderate, rational peace, which might pave the way for a revival of democracy. But these trends are still nebulous. In considering our own course in world affairs, it is important to remember that Congress, as well as the president, has a share in American foreign policy. While the president has wide powers under the Constitution, Congress makes the laws and grants the appropriations under which the conduct of foreign relations is carried out by the executive. For several years, Congress has acted as a brake on the executive branch of the government. Last summer, Before the outbreak of war, Congress refused to amend the Neutrality Act. In November, it lifted the arms embargo but insisted at the same time on mandatory cash and carry provisions designed to insulate us against some of the shocks of war. There were many in Congress who did not accept Mr. Roosevelt's thesis that our interests were directly linked with those of Great Britain and France, and who still sought to impose a break on the president. It remains to be seen whether congressional minds have been changed by the Soviet invasion of Finland and the course of the war in Europe. This week, however, there seemed to be little open dissent from the president's statement of foreign policy, except on the request for renewal of the trade agreement program. The Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act expires next June 12, unless it is extended by Congress before that time. Under the present law, Secretary Hull has negotiated agreements with 21 countries, representing about 60% of our total foreign trade. But Mr. Hull and the administration face a determined opposition, which includes not only Republicans, but also a number of Democrats from the Western farm states who claim that the agreements have injured American agriculture. Mr. Hull meets these claims with figures to show that our farmers have not been injured. He points out that most of the products which have been allowed to enter the country do not compete with the crops raised by our own farmers, but are commodities like coffee, rubber, bananas, and other tropical products. Only the other day, negotiations for a trade agreement with Argentina were suspended, partly because the State Department was unwilling to make concessions on Argentine farm products, which might perhaps have injured our domestic farmers. But Mr. Hull's strongest argument is the need for retaining a liberal trade policy after the present war. In a recent Chicago speech, Mr. Hull declared that if there is anything certain in this world, it is that after the present hostilities have come to an end, there will be an even more desperate need for vigorous action designed to restore and promote healthy and mutually beneficial trade among nations. On national defense, the second definite request made by Mr. Roosevelt, Congress has already shown its readiness to appropriate such additional funds as may be necessary for adequate defense. But the question Congress will have to determine is what constitutes adequate defense. The budget estimate sent to Congress by Mr. Roosevelt on Thursday called for a staggering total of $2,248,000,000 for the Army and Navy, an increase of about $460 million over the total voted by Congress last year. This new budget is to be divided into two parts, one classed as regular, the other emergency. The first is described as covering the normal defense preparations, while the latter covers increases in the Army and Navy begun last September because of the European war. Whether or not these funds are adequate depends on the answer which Congress gives to the larger question of national policy. If our foreign policy is limited to defense of our territory in the Western Hemisphere, then they are probably more than adequate. But if our policy is to call for armed intervention in Europe or the Far East, then they are probably not adequate. President Roosevelt did not mention American policy in the Far East, but some in Congress believe that Asia may be perhaps more important than Europe in the days which lie ahead. For it is there that we are seeking to maintain rights and interests which have been challenged by Japan's new order in Asia, and where our Navy has long served as an instrument of national policy.
You have been listening to Mr. William T. Stone, Vice President of the Foreign Policy Association and Director of its Washington Bureau, speaking in the America Looks Abroad series from the NBC studios in Washington. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. If you are interested in knowing the facts behind the headlines, send for a free copy of the weekly bulletin written by the people you hear on this program and carrying a special article by Mr. Stone. Address your letter or postcard to the Foreign Policy Association at 8 West 40th Street, New York City. Tune in to this station next Sunday at 3:15 to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company.